gracias, una vez más. One of the members, I take this opportunity to welcome you all in this very important meeting. And I welcome you from a long recess. I think three weeks is too long from the recess. And hoping that you had enough time to rest. No, I understand. You didn't rest, Honorable Member. I know you were busy with your constituency work, so you never enjoyed any rest. But I think you managed to get at least 12 hours a day to rest. And I also wish to extend my welcome to the department led by Ms. Ngomizulu today. Ne? Am I right? It's still advocate. Oh, because it's legal unit. Okay. Led by advocate Gladys. And welcome everybody. And amongst ourselves, I wish to welcome the researcher for the portfolio committee dedicated to human settlements. At last, Parliament has appointed a researcher for us, and we welcome you, Liepo Rai. Am I correct? Yes. This is the portfolio committee of human settlements. You are going to provide support to this committee. And this committee is one of the committees in Parliament, or is amongst the committees in Parliament that are working hard. There's no rest, there's quite a lot of flexi hours. You work flexi hours, no breaks, nothing. So we are going to work again. I will see you in Beto yesintu le. Beto yesintu, ifike emzini kutakata, nawe uyatakata. So we hope that you will follow apha ebugqirheni bale komiti. Ubugqirha obokusebenza nzima. And we do trust that you will enjoy working with this team. This is a team, a lively, a team that is caring, a team we live as a family in this team. So, Funeka Njuzas, good to one killing, Kusekaya Nalapa. With those few words, I wish to welcome everybody. I think we do have our public observers and the researchers from the respective parties in Parliament. These legislations are very much interesting. I could see that everybody here. And then we have our Berenice, the senior researcher, who has been assisting us in this process. And we would like to indicate that the services of the senior researcher will continue until such time we finalize these two pieces of legislation. Although we know that it's going to go beyond that, but she's going to be full time until we finalize this. She's going to work closely with us and assist the Mr. Zwai. Thank you very much. I wish to hand over to the department. We left when we were before we left, we were dealing with the sectional title scheme management bill, and we went as far as page 12. Am I correct? Yes. I think we'll start there, clause by clause, and then you will lead us. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. So thanks to Honorable Members. We'll start with the insurance by owners.
Sorry. Oh, for the disadvantage, for the advantage one, we are on page 34. I mean, yeah, page 30, not 34, page 30. The advantaged one, those are the disadvantaged, you are advantaged. Got it. And then page 30 of this research work, parliamentary research work. No, Benny, now last time, I said, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thanks to Honorable Members. On page 12, clause 13, heading insurance by owners. 13.1. Notwithstanding the existence of a valid insurance policy effected by the body corporate pursuant to the provisions of Section 13.1F, an owner may obtain an insurance policy in respect of any damage to his or her section arising from risk covered by the policy effected by the body corporate. Agreed.
I think it should on the 13.1D.F.
Yes, we have done that. Amendment to read, you know, in terms of us, but yes.
Are you saying pursuant to the provision of Section 3.1G? That's what you are saying. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry. I think we need to just refer back to that 3.1G to make sure that that is correct. And I think it is, but I think before we start making changes, we need to be sure. G, it says to insure the building or buildings and keep it or them insured to the replacement value thereof against fire and such others as described. So I think it does refer to that, 1G.
Okay. Two, where the insurance policy contemplated in subsection 1 is in force, and A, where the damage to the section is made good by the body corporate pursuant to section 3.1H, the insurer is not liable in terms of the insurance policy obtained by the owner, and H it will be I. B.
Just a question regarding that last part of the sentence. The insurer is not liable in terms of the insurance policy obtained by the owner. Aren't we being prescriptive to the insured to the company? Do we actually need that? That is between the insured and the insurance. We are prescribing to an insured company that they are not liable if an owner obtained another insurance. But
and only in circumstances where the damage has in fact been made good under the body corporate's policy. So you're avoiding, the purpose of this entire clause is to cater for duplicate insurance, but to mesh the provisions of the two. So if in a situation where the body corporate has its insurance and the owner has insurance and the body corporate makes good, then there really is no point in holding the second, the owner's insurer, liable.
But my point is this, why should we subscribe to the insured company? I would imagine in their policies, if there's an instance where there are two policies for the same thing, and based on whatever criteria the one is held liable and they repair, that the second one is then not... what I'm saying is, why must we prescribe in this thing that the second one will then not have to pay? Should we not leave it up to those two companies?
Honorable, thank you, sir. I just want to enrich my mind. Is it not are you not over-insured if you have duplicate insurances in this setup?
No, you're not. This setup is designed to allow an owner the freedom to go and take their own insurance if they're not happy. You see, when the body corporate makes a decision to insure, they do it by a majority vote. The amount of the insurance and the risks and perils are all things that they're going to decide on by an agreement between the owners. But one has to, what this section recognizes is that a particular owner might not agree with that. And he or she might want to go out and take their own insurance because they don't believe. The majority rules is fine, but if you don't think that they're insuring for all the perils that you want to be insured for, you should be entitled, and you are entitled. You see, you're creating this communality, but then you also have to create exceptions to the communality so as to provide fairness to the individual people. They have to have the freedom of choice to take out at their own expense more insurance if they want to. And just because I can't convince you and this whole group of you that we need insurance against landslip shouldn't stop me going and getting insurance against landslip at my own expense. This is in fact a thing that facilitates the freedom of an individual who doesn't have exclusive ownership rights to that area to protect their own interests. Does that make sense? And on your one, I do believe that every insurance contract is more or less, in my mind, like a bet. It will something happen. If it does, then you're going to pay me some money. So I do believe that turning off this bet in a situation where the peril or risk has been dealt with by somebody else is a sensible thing to do.
I fully agree with the freedom for an owner to take out an additional insurance. What I don't agree with is that we are now prescribing to the insured company that should the first insurance make good, that they are not liable. Now, what I'm saying is, who are we now to prescribe to them? Surely insurance companies have got certain regulations whereby if you happen to take out two policies for the same thing, that there's some mechanism to determine that if it's been covered by one, that the second one doesn't necessarily have to pay for the same thing. So all I'm saying is, yes, we've got the freedom, but why do we now turn that freedom, sort of close it in terms of telling the second insurer you will not be liable because it's been fixed by the first one? I'm saying leave it up to them. That's what I'm saying.
Honorable Stain is covering the point that I wanted to raise, because if it is a matter of choice, surely we shouldn't prescribe in such a way that we are disadvantaging the person who is insured. If your explanation really means what I thought you were saying, I thought what you were saying in general is that it would be a collective obligation that everyone should be part of the insurance. But if you don't want to be part of that one, and then you can choose whatever insurance that you want to choose. I think the point that we want to raise that it would verify it. Is that therefore we can't go on and say, no, the second insurer cannot pay the first one has paid to pay. I think that is the point that you are raising. But if you are not saying that, then you are saying that the person, I agree on the freedom of choice. People can choose whatever insurance. If the person doesn't want to be part of the broader scheme of insurance, it's fine. But we can't go on and say, no, if you have two insurances, if one pays, then the one is not liable. I think that's the point that you're trying to raise. If the language is structured, it doesn't mean that. It's a separate insurance.
It doesn't mean that. What you just described is a situation where somebody could opt out of the communal insurance, and that's not the case at all. The body corporate's obligation to insure at least against fire is a mandatory statutory obligation. You can't, insofar as you thought that somebody could say, no, I want to go to a different insurance company or something, that's not the case. The body corporate does have to insure the entire building, every bit of it, against at least fire and such other risks as are prescribed. When somebody, the freedom that we're talking about is the freedom to insure in addition to that. You're still going to pay your levy towards that insurance, but you have the right to put your hand in your back pocket and pay some more money. I don't pretend to be an expert in insurance, but I know that the question of double insurance is complicated. And may I suggest that before you make a decision to take that thing out, get somebody who is a genius on double cover, just to see whether or not that would have some unintended result.
I think what we need to solve here is to ensure that these clauses, they are user friendly, because Professor Paddock will not be there when the problems really come out. So I think we need to look at this in a more comprehensive as Professor Fetchie. Otherwise, we're going to lose it. Let's make it a point that it is rephrased, you work it in a manner that is going to be user friendly. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. 2B, where the damage to the section is covered by the insurance policy effected by the body corporate pursuant to section 31F, but is not made good by the body corporate insurer, is liable in terms of the insurance policy effected by the owner. C, where the damage to the section is not covered by the insurance policy effected by the body corporate, the terms and conditions of the insurance policy obtained by the owner apply.
Mr. Stoller, before I stay, and then Honourable Bowman, and lastly, Ms. Ntarane.
Thank you, Chair. On, I think, 3.1P again, on that one, 31F, 3.1F.
May I also just request, if the department is already aware of a clause that needs to be changed, when they read it, they must read the new one, because it is confusing. It should be G. Otherwise, we're going to keep on bringing it up.
Okay.
But really, my question now is on C there, where the damage to the section is not covered by the insurance policy. This is exactly the opposite of the first one. We're now saying it's fine for the other policy to come to kick in. But really, the point is then, you know, why we say it's not covered, then why insure it if it's not covered? It's just some anomaly here that we'll be taking out insurance on something and then discover when something happens that it's actually not covered. That is what we're implying. And then we expect the owner to have taken out the second one to cover that. So this whole thing is about we're trying to tell a third party what they must and must not do. And I'm saying we should stay out of that, and if a individual wants to take out a policy that they think will cover something that is not covered by the general one, then really it's between that individual and his or her insurance company. We mustn't prescribe to the insurance companies now when they can pay and when they cannot. And that's really what my argument is in this whole clause.
Thank you, Chair.
No, I'm actually covered. But I wonder if it wouldn't be advisable, as you stated earlier on that previous section, to say, you know, can we not perhaps go back? It looks to me as if maybe this whole clause needs to be looked at and just perhaps fine-tuned or something, because there seems to be some doubt about it.
Thank you,
was going to request the professor that if he put it in my own simple English to understand exactly. I understand that the legally processed document and everything are very difficult. Some are very to read them because they sound very contradictory, but they are not. It's just the language sometimes that is played around. But in simple English, what is the difference between C and A? And because I think I agree in terms of striking a good balance in protecting the property, but at the same time protecting the consumer. I think it's fine. I'm just trying just to get what is the, in simple English, what is the difference between two. Because we should protect, I think, the owner, and then in terms of fire and everything, but also we should protect the consumer too. Because it seems you are saying a person can have two insurance, but one may pay, one may not pay, but the second one is almost obliging the second one also to consider paying, even if not. And then to me, it's a little bit very complex to understand the flow of it. What does it mean in simple English?
Can I try and tell you in simple English? Or? Thank you. The context of this clause is, as you know, that body corporate has an obligation to insure the entire building. That's going to happen, whether they like it or not, and that money is going to come from the central fund. If an owner, an individual owner, feels that insurance doesn't go far enough in terms of money or doesn't go wide enough in terms of risks, that owner can take out their own insurance. That's got nothing to do with the body corporate. It's a contract that he goes to his broker, or to the insurance company, and he places a brand new and different contract of insurance. The subject of the insurance is the same thing, but the actual contract, the risk bet that is taken, is an entirely different one. Now, what this 13.2 does is unpack the situation where there is such a second insurance policy in place and there is damage. Now, when that happens, and if that damage is not covered, sorry, what 2A says, if you do have a duplication, if it's covered in terms of one and it is paid in terms of the body corporate's one, then the second insurer is not liable to that owner. That's what Mr. Stain is saying shouldn't be there, but that's the simple effect of it. Is that clear? Okay. Then if we go to B, when the damage to the section is covered but isn't made good, so now it is covered, we're postulating, also we are thinking ourselves into a situation where both insurers are on the hook. Both of them are liable to pay. But the body corporate's insurer doesn't pay. Now the owner's insurer must pay. Okay? And then...
Why should we allow that the first is not done well? Why should we allow that?
It's not a question of letting the body corporate off the hook. It's not you're not allowing them to get away with anything. The situation is that the insurance that they took out doesn't cover that particular risk. Can I give you an example? And I'm just going to make this up, but I hope it might help. If there is insurance against fire, but the body corporate's policy only covers you for a month of loss of rental in the event of a fire. Because they've decided that's how much everybody's prepared to pay for. You know, you want to pay for a year's worth of cover for loss of rental, well, it's going to cost you more. No, the body corporate only want a month's worth. And this owner says, no, I'm in the business of letting out my unit, and I'd like 6 months, because I think it's going to take us 6 months to be able to rehabilitate the unit and get the interest, get my rental back. So that owner says, I understand what you lot are and what all of us are doing, but I want more cover. I want something else. I want this additional peril, these extra 5 months also covered. I'm prepared to pay for that. So in that situation, this section allows the owner, even though he's not the owner of the property, he's a co-owner, this section allows him to go and place that insurance with an insurance company, really for his own benefit. Nobody but he is going to be paid out. And one's not letting the body corporate off the hook, Madam Chairperson, one is allowing an owner to enter into a contract of insurance for an issue not covered by the body corporate's policy. Okay.
Okay. Now, you mentioned something as a co-owner, and in this legislation, we don't have something like that. So, I don't know.
Let me check this. We do. Every single owner is a co-owner of all the common property. You own your section exclusively, but you are a co-owner with all the other owners. The very fundament of sectional title, Madam Chairperson, is that you are the exclusive owner of your section, and you are a co-owner of all the common property. So that is one of the reasons you have to have provisions like this. It is a type of property ownership that has two different parts to it. The ownership of your section is exclusive, but the ownership of the common property is shared. That's why we need insurance policy provisions like this.
I think I'm trying to understand. I think the professor is trying to assist me to understand this. And I know that it's very complex. I don't think it's very easy to write any bill in a very simple language. It's what I always prefer. It's a very simple written bill. Because we don't want a bill that would have to be interpreted by lawyers every day when we have a problem. I thought that the bill is meant for people who are not necessarily here, who will be owning all these taxes, the national taxes, and other issues. But generally, they don't sit here. Some of them, anyway, they will not be lawyers. Then we should be writing it in a manner proper, so that is very simple for interpretation. Because even now, I'm trying just to digest what here we are putting. So the point that there's a problem. I thought that you were going to be saying with now. The body corporate insurance one, therefore, everyone is compulsory. Everyone must have it in terms of fire or storms or floods. But it's not only fire, there will be also floods sometimes in other areas. And then I guess that's the problem. But I thought that we shouldn't limit the person who is also paying a second insurance, depending on what happens with the first one, and the second one may decide or not die. Okay, I don't think that one should. I thought that really the question of the two parties really engaged in their obligation. If I pay you to cover me really, therefore you must cover me accordingly. Unless there's a way that we are putting it, that if it is not covered by the corporate insurer, therefore the person will be covered at the second level. You have to make it very clear for people about disability, because surely the reason why a person will go for a second one is precisely because the corporate one is not sufficient. And therefore, because it's not sufficient, that's why I would go for it. If it's sufficient, I wouldn't go for a second one. Therefore, there are things that are not covered. Therefore, if things that are covered by the corporate one must pay, but the extras must be paid by my second insurance. Otherwise, the whole issue would be unfair to a consumer who's paying if they depend on it. I thought that's the point that I wanted to raise. But if the language anyway is covering those points, I'll be happy.
At the risk of annoying you very substantially, let me say that this provision has worked and the insurance industry has been perfectly happy with it, as have sectional title owners, for about 30 years. I know that that's not not your primary concern.
It's not our primary concern, because we're dealing with the consumers here. So I think let's stick to the agenda, because really, as we are saying, this language is too difficult. If we cannot interpret it as legislators, how much do the people on the ground? So that is why we have to make the point that the legislation is clear, user-friendly. But if it's not, I think the drafters can go back and redraft it. Because our main concern as the legislators is the consumer. All consumers.
Thank you. Sure. Yeah, I think we're going around in circles. I think, look, what is being said in terms of, certainly by Richard as well as the professor, that the owners must be given a choice to get the additional insurance. Now, that's covered in Clause 1, and that must stay. I believe Clause 2 must come out completely. Because if I enter into an agreement with an insurance company, I think that contract will take precedence over this. And here we really, as I've said before, we're prescribing to the insured company when they're liable or not liable. So in terms of clause 2, my personal opinion is that that should come out, because in fact, I think the professor contradicted himself a little bit to your question, Chairperson, and Richards, where the question was asked, why would the body corporate, the way it's written here, it actually says where the damage to the section is covered by the insurance policy affected by the body corporate. So it's covered. But then it continues to say, but it's not made good by the body corporate. And that was the chairperson's question. If it's covered by that insurance, but the body corporate isn't made good, I believe they don't have a choice because it's been covered by that one. So it's a bit of a contradiction here. Or we're telling the body corporate that you may or you may not, in which case my personal insurance is going to kick in. And therefore, I believe clause 2 should come out. We're just trying to be prescriptive. We're giving in clause 1 the owner the opportunity. What I do think, however, we should go back to the clause where we talk about the insurance that the body corporate should take out. And this goes to Richard's point again. We should perhaps put something in there that compels the body corporate to make the rest of the owners aware of something that may not be covered by the global policy in case they wish to take out an additional policy. So people need to be made aware. This is what our policy, the common policy covers, and should you wish to take out, this is what it doesn't cover, therefore you've got the option of taking out a personal insurance for the second thing. So maybe at some clause that we've passed early in terms of the body corporate insurance, we need to put something in there that compels them to inform the rest of the owners, really, that there's a risk that hasn't been covered, should they wish to do it themselves. Thank you, Chair.
You know, with all this legislation, there's a lot of cross-referencing as well. And I see within this, there's, you know, quite apart from the reference back to the Clause 3 and those components, there's also a reference to Clause 16. I think I saw that, or did I not see that? I must have seen it. Oh, yes, it's in 3. This is where it becomes a bit complicated. If you now turn to 3I, subject to Section 16, it says now there's a whole lot of stuff under Section 16 that might be referenced. I'm just a little afraid that if we're taking out something because of the cross-referencing, we're actually missing something. And I really think that maybe the legal minds need to go back and look at it properly. And I'm fully behind the support for the better English, the easier language, the more user-friendly language, so that we do understand it. But I'm just pleading that we check these cross-references properly.
All in agreement that the members are not happy about this 13.13.2. So we request that you work these to in such a manner that is going to be understood by an ordinary person. So, if we can have.
Maybe this question I'm going to ask was covered previously during my absence. What I want to find out, I just need clarity. At what stage does the owner know what is covered by the body corporate?
The insurance policy is one of the items that is dealt with at every annual general meeting. That doesn't necessarily mean, however, that a full copy of the policy is sent out. The schedules that indicate what amounts are allocated to every section have to be sent out, but I think that there may be room for Honourable Stan's suggestion that whether that's in the Act or the regulations, that more detail of the specific risks be set up.
No, I think we have given a ruling that maybe should pass on this one. It's just the team should just rewrite it in our, in order for us just to understand. I think the essence of it, really, I think now I follow the essence of what the terms are doing, but in terms of ways that are here that are too complicated for me to just comprehend what is really meant by. And then I guess that you rewrite it in a manner that will be easy even for us to understand. And then,
may I just ask, I'm hearing take it out, I'm hearing rewrite it. Which would you prefer?
The point, of course, I'm trying not to differ with what I would say, but I think if you rewrite it in a manner that will understand that there's no contradiction A and C, and then because there's B, there's A, and then also there's C. And then that there should be flow in terms of your language, that the point A and point B, they're almost, because at the moment they're much more confused than B. I think if you rework with them in a manner that assists us, again, to articulate exactly what you meant. Because when we're explaining it, at least I comprehended what is the point that you're trying to raise here. But in terms of the words as they appear, it's very difficult for me to do so. I think if you can rework it on that way. And then at the principal level, I agree with the state that we shouldn't try to be over-prescribed in terms of the insurer and the owner. And then in my view, I think that would be fine. But I think it's important to cover the two points. And also somewhere we should be able to, because I think we have been working on this matter of the section attack for many years now, almost 8 years, whatever it is. But you also bear in mind that very few people read legal documents. Even the highly learned one anyway, they don't read the legal documents. In fact, very few of us who know the escape clauses in any legal document. And therefore, generally, there's very little people read. Therefore, it's important for people who are owners, or co-owners of this property, at least to know exactly what the insurance, the property insurance cover, what does it cover. Whether that one is addendum on the end or not addendum on the end is a separate matter. But we need a share to someone that will really be able to do that, but not by the end, by the corporate body. To say that in terms of this insurance will cover this, but other areas are not covered. And that will give guidance for members. Because there are areas also people that they think that they are covered for totality of what they possess. They find that it's only two things that are covered. I think sometimes very difficult. I think if you can do that, the share will fall. And then the corporate board will do is to start how they be, how they do things. I think in general we've done that. But in terms of what is covered or is not covered, it will be explained. It will be very compulsory to be explained to any person who comes in. If I'm a new person, I'm already their corporate, everything must be explained in order for me to take an informed decision whether I need the second insurer or I don't need it at all. Because
cover the totality of what I possess. I think for me, if you can do that, in whatever language, I think we'll assist us a lot.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Therefore, there was an earlier suggestion by Honorable Mr. Steyn to say that, therefore, we need a casino to omit B and therefore reweight A and C. So I'm just trying to check as to whether the particular motion was supported.
I think what Mr. Steyn was clear. Because Mr. Steyn, in my understanding, he said because there are contradictions, we need to remove B, A and B. Is it A and C or A and B? But at the end of if I listened to him properly, he even said, or we would rather remove them and rephrase it. But it must not be, it must be clear that we must not prescribe to the insurer because we are denying the owner his rights. Can you clarify?
Yeah. Chair, my recommendation was that the entire clause 2 be taken out. But what I want to suggest is, because the entire clause 2 deals with which insurance is going to cover what. And I'm saying perhaps we need to get some information from insurance companies, because my understanding would be that that contract between them and myself would take precedence over here. And if we can get that clarity, then we in fact don't need to start telling them when the one pays, when the other one doesn't pay, etc. Because the very first clause, 13.1, makes the provision that any owner can take out the additional insurance. And I think we've now, and my colleagues have agreed, at some point in this thing, they need to be made aware of the risks that are not covered so they can exercise that option. So I'm very much in favor of giving them the option to take out an additional insurance. But when it comes to this document telling the insurer that you won't pay because he's paying, and when he doesn't pay, you pay. That's the sort of thing that we have in 2A, B, and C. So I think subject to us getting more information of what would take precedence in a situation like this between insurance companies, we then either rewrite it or we then delete it.
Each other, please.
Thank you, Chair. 13.3, this section does not limit the rights of an owner to insure against risk other than damage to his or her section.
Yeah, Chair, I sort of understand this, but again, now we're going to telling Richard he can insure on the common property now, because we're saying very specifically other than his or her section. Now, I'm not sure if, first of all, if the insurance companies will allow me to insure Richard's car, for example. And that's making a crude example. Or why would I want to take out an insurance that would cover the common property? But I'm going to pay the premium, but everybody's going to benefit, because that's really what we're saying here. I don't really care whether it stays in or not, but I'm just querying this. Why would anybody want to insure something that everybody else is going to benefit on, but I'm going to carry the premium? That, as has been said, the common property is taken by the insurance that the body corporate takes out. So I don't know what, I mean, if it's not my section, why would I insure it? And will the insurance company allow me to insure something at somebody else's property? Although I'm a co-owner, though.
Mr. Stan, you make the assumption that it's because it's not part of your section, it's somebody else's property, but that isn't necessarily the case. So the definition, this thing takes into account a rather strict definition, which is in the Act, of what a section is. A section goes to the median line of the exterior walls, floors, and ceilings, although there is some flexibility allowed by the Surveyor General. So it is entirely possible that an owner may wish to insure against damage to the common property that's adjacent to his section. He may also, and normally, the absolutely bog-standard insurance policy that you will get if you take out insurance law and sectional title law is not exactly the same. It's not an exact fit. So, for example, if you go to an insurance company and say, what does your normal fire insurance company cover, they'll say, and they want to give you an example, they'll say, if you could pick up the building, turn it upside down and shake it, then what falls out is not covered, that's your movables and that sort of thing, but what stays in is that's how a broker would explain it to somebody who didn't understand. But, of course, think about your fitted carpets. Think about those kitchen cupboards. Think about the built-in units, things like air conditioners and various other things, which are not part of the section per se, but which you might want to cover and which are normally covered in terms of such a policy. So this thing allows somebody, again, we're touching on something that we spoke of the last time we got together, and that is where somebody is given the right to insure something of which he doesn't hold the full insurable interest in law. So but here he is allowed both things that he does have, items that might technically even be movable, would be covered by that. Also, certain things of which he's only a co-owner. It just widens up an owner's right in law to take out that contract.
Professor, no, I think I agree with you on this one. It would be a real matter of choice for that owner. And because the body corporate will cover the entire thing. if a person do have resources to cover more than what is prescribed. I think it's a matter of choice. I think we should accept that. It doesn't really cause any damage to the act. It allows more choice for individual who got more resources to do so because of whatever interest. Because individual will have the interest in terms of their own section, but they may have an interest beyond their own section. That doesn't because what is commonly owned has a negative impact to what is owned by individual too. And I think in that sense, no, I think it makes sense. At least I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Recovery from owners of uncertified judgment against bodies corporate and non-liability of bodies corporate for debts and obligations of developers. 14.1a, if a creditor of a body corporate has obtained judgment against the body corporate and such judgment notwithstanding the issue of writ remains uncertified, the judgment creditor may, without prejudice to any other remedy, he or she may have, and subject to paragraph C, apply to the court which gave the judgment for the joinder of the members of the body corporate in their personal capacities as joint judgment debtors in respect of the debt, of the in respect of the judgment debt.
It's very much overloaded. I'm not sure whether the meaning is the same. I think lawyers anyway are very skillful in this area of work. But in my view, it's too much overloaded. If you could put it in a very simple way. Because when you read it, it's a huge thing, but it says one thing, you know. But it's overloaded. I guess that, of course, in the law, you could do that. There's no harm on it anyway to accept it. That's really too overloaded.
But I wanted to
I wanted just to come back to, I think I'm taking the committee as told you will forgive me. On 13.1, notwithstanding what, and then we move on and insurance policies in respect of any damage to his or her section arising from the rift. Why we wouldn't put in not covered by the policy affected by the body corporate? Why we didn't put not covered? Because I think then it makes 2A, 2B, and C almost redundant. Is there any harm on that one? I'm just saying that you didn't put not covered. That's the point that I'm raising. Why can't you put and then the insurance policy in respect of any damage or his or her section arising from the risk not covered by the policy affected by body coverage.
I think in your indulgence, let's keep with that. They must rephrase, they must do what we have said they must want to do, and then those comments are very much important for us. So in our next meeting, when we look at their structure of these sentences, then we can re-amend, as long as we have not adopted this legislation, this bill, we are going to re-amend and amend and amend until we are satisfied as the members. But I think you should take that quiz that Honorable Mzagani has raised, and then you will consider it when you are restructuring this this clause. You can take it now, for now, so that you look at it. Otherwise, we can wait this legislation until we are satisfied. A concern about this 14.1a, does that refer to after the issue has been referred to the dispute resolution that is going to be handled by the Ombuds Service? Because I think rushing to the court, we will talk about that. So does that mean that this judgment But the, yeah, this judgment refers to the dispute resolution mechanism, prior.
No, Madam Chairman, it doesn't. The end point of an adjudication under the Community Scheme Ombuds Service is at the giving of an award, and that award can be turned into a court judgment. So there still has to be a judgment. This situation will work perfectly well with the Community Scheme Ombuds Service. There's no conflict between this and that, because in any event, your end point of a successful adjudication under the Community Scheme Ombuds Service will end up in something that is a court order. You won't have to go through the court process, but you will get a court order. And it's only when you have a court order that the execution, that the process, that the creditor who has got the rights now, that's been made clear now by the adjudication system that the rights are in place. Now it goes to the court process to actually execute against the property. So there's no conflict at all.
Fourteen B. Upon such joinder, the judgment creditor may recover the amount of the judgment debt still outstanding from the said members on a pro rata basis in proportion to their respective quotas or a determination made in terms of section 9(2). In terms of, but it's going to be 10(2). Going to be 10(2). That's the rule. Effect of quota comparison. Going to be 10(2). Yeah, going to be 10(2).
Whether this word determination is being replaced by a rule, or is it as it is? I came across something where that was being looked at.
Thank you, Chair. C. Any member of the body corporate who has paid the contributions due by him or her in terms of Section 31B to the body corporate in respect of the same debt prior to the judgment against the body corporate may not be joined as a joint judgment debtor in respect of the judgment debt. Two, no debt or obligation arising from any agreement between the developer and any other person is enforceable against the body corporate.
Okay, I agree with it. I'm just wondering if we that we're actually not taking it far enough, because we're referring specifically between a developer and any other person, but one can get instances, and I thought that was what 14.1A referred to, where In the normal event of things where there's a creditor that has done some work to the buildings, obviously, and the body corporate hasn't paid for whatever reason, that this whole thing applies. Now, similarly, we should try and broaden it so it's not just the developer, but it could be any other third party or second party, really, if I, for whatever reason, go into a contract with somebody to come and do some work to some common property, and that supplier is not aware that I don't have the authority, And then we end up in a situation where I, as an owner, have gotten the body corporate into debt. So what I'm saying is perhaps we're not broadening this enough. We're confining it to a developer and any other person. But it should really be broader than that, where no individual owner can enter into any sort of contract that will bind the body corporate. And that's what I'm trying to get at.
This provision was inserted specifically as consumer protection provisions, protection against developers. It didn't contemplate anything else, and so it hadn't thought of that. But just in terms of the ordinary law, and if you don't have the authority to bind the body corporate, then the body corporate isn't bound. And I think that's the situation which you described struck my ear as being strange, because it is only those people who have either implied or written authority from the body corporate. And an owner could not, in law, go out and say to a contractor, come and fix the gate, it's not working. The contractor wouldn't have a claim against the body corporate except on the basis of enrichment. So from a pure contract point of view, I'm not sure that's necessary. Certainly, it's not a situation I've ever seen annoying body corporates or being abused by owners.
Thank you, Chair. Appointment of administrators. Clause 15.1. A body corporate, a local authority, a judgment creditor of the body corporate, where the judgment amount is not less than 500, or any owner or any person having registered real right in or over a unit may apply to the court for the appointment of an administrator.
Chairperson, I think throughout we've changed the local authority to municipality.
Yes.
That needs to be changed.
Yes. Oh. 15.1, a body corporate, a local authority. Thank you, Honourable Chair. A body corporate, a local municipality, a judgment creditor of the body corporate, where the judgment amount is not less than 500, or any owner or any person having registered real right in or over a unit may apply to the court for the appointment of an administrator.
I just want to query this, and I've picked up, I haven't been here in all the deliberations, but when we talk about a municipality, we talk about a municipality, I think. We don't talk about a local municipality. It's a local authority. So, and I've picked that up in other amendments, so we might have to go back, but I think we need to just be accurate with that.
So we defined it in terms of the Structures Act. Yeah, I think if they are local, we have to. Yes.
I think in the first sentence between municipality and judgment creditor that we should put in the word or. O-R. And then my question is really, and I think we've picked this up somewhere else, where we would prefer to see the first instance is relief from the ombudsman. Why in this instance is it directly to a court for an administrator? Should we not sort of be consistent and see that as the first access for relief?
That was our main concern, because we said, work this according to that, at least we must follow the dispute resolution mechanisms in terms of utilizing the ombud service. And then courts will be the last resort. So, but now, that is why I said read it again. Because if you are just, you can just take, let's say, delete court in every area where we come across court without reading and understanding the meaning of that clause, we are going to lose it. So that is why I was saying read it again, so that if that court is not supposed to be there, it must be at the end. You must first follow the ombuds service, because these pieces of legislation, we are going to pass them once. We are not going to pass one and then we leave. We can't, because the other one cannot operate without the other one. So you have to make it a point that there's that integration, there's that alignment. The other one must speak to the other one.
On Mr. Stan's point of the or, there is in fact a series of people who are entitled to make that application. You will see that it's a body corporate, a local authority, an owner, or any person having a registered real right. So the or comes a bit later. You could put another or there, but it's not necessary to make sense of it. On the question of whether this appointment should be made by the chief ombuds, that is obviously something that this committee will decide. Can I just make a few points? The appointment of an administrator may be, in terms of this clause, as you will see as it unpacks, may in fact take all the rights away from owners. It might end up with somebody running the body corporate as a judicial manager might run a company, as a trustee might run a trustee, somebody with complete power. So traditionally, it's been considered that the High Court is the appropriate organ to make that appointment, because it's so potentially serious. That doesn't mean you can't change that. If you leave it as the High Court making the appointment, then might we suggest that you then say under the supervision of the chief ombud, that could tie the two together, so that there's some degree of supervision. The alternative, of course, is to expand the mandate of the chief ombud to allow hearings of that sort and to allow an adjudicator to make that appointment. That's really in your hands. But I think, may I also suggest that you ask for Bongiwa's input on this, because I think she may have some sensible suggestions.
Let me ask. Do you have an administrator? Have you defined the administrator in this legislation? Who is the administrator? Or is the administrator same thing as the managing agent? What is it?
No, Madam Chair. The managing agent is somebody who, by virtue of a contract, does some or all of the work of the trustees. The administrator, in fact, there is a string of High Court cases that deal with administration, and there is quite clear law in that regard. The High Court does not appoint an administrator under this provision unless the body corporate is in real trouble. And generally speaking, they don't look just for some confusion or some problems, some personality difficulties within the scheme. It's when there's serious financial problem. And there are a substantial number of schemes in South Africa that are under administration. So it is not like a managing agent. Once somebody has been appointed as an administrator, they are in control, and the owners really take a back seat in most cases. So it's a very serious thing. It's not the same as appointing a managing agent who you can fire if you don't like them after a while. It is the court, or if you wanted it to be, it could be the ombuds service, putting the care. It is the same as the liquid. It's not actually the liquidator of a company, but it's quite similar in a way to somebody who has the power to manage the scheme. I think the judicial management analogy, if that one makes sense to you, is the very best analogy. It is the sectional title equivalent of a judicial manager in the company context. And it's that, for that reason that the High Court is considered appropriate, or has been thus far.
Well, office. You are welcome. Council, brilliant, Anna.
I was going to suggest that perhaps we can, myself and the department, we can look into this clause and then get back to you with a well-informed advice. And, yeah, during our next meeting, we can get back to you.
Well, thank you, Honorable Chair. 15.2. A, the court may, in its discretion, appoint an administrator for an indefinite or a fixed period and on such terms and conditions, including remuneration, as it deems fit.
Let me tell you. Well, why can't you just let this the whole, the whole 15, so that we don't miss it, just allow yourself to work it on it, and then, okay, thanks.
Look, clause 16.
And then, because I just gather somewhere, we agree that there will be administrator if there are serious judicial matters. When really the money issues can't account the board, because we need the administrator to work on that. I think the point that maybe we are taking back is the issue of whether you want the ombudsman to do that or a court. And then because other issues will be consequential really if we have resolved that, whether it's the ombudsman that will then take a decision through negotiation, whatever thing, or the Supreme Court. And that's the point that I think if you are saying that, Chair, then I think it would be fine. Because there will be a lot of team anyway that will really waste money and then get involved in serious financial problems. Surely the body corporate have to apply to the court or whatever, whether it's an ombudsman or a court. But general judgment are given by court. And then I think Bong and the team, they'll work it out really. So general judgment are given by court for the joiner. And then I think we'll have to rework it all out. But I think the essence of it, at least, I think we understand that we need administrative that still has problems. And then the ombudsman or the court will decide whether a person is for 6 months or 20 years, depending on the circumstances. I think that is very fine. I know my cousin is right, doesn't agree with me. He wants 6 months fixed. Otherwise, that means that I can be there forever. But I think if you are saying that, because there are two issues there that you are looking at, ombudsman working on this matter, or the High Court making a declaration or taking a judgment. And then to me, that would be fine. I think we both in the team, they can assist us straight on that.
Thank you, Chair. My problem with the administrative chairperson is that they'll drag the process and it will cost the body corporate. Why don't we go for something like if this issue can be handled by the ombudsman? I think it will be much cheaper than going for the court, and the administrators always will drag this because they claim lots of money by managing those things. I know for a fact. Yes. Thank you, Chair.
Manditi, issue your makelwane, but at the same time, it also assists us because we have already agreed that all state law advisors, they have to work with accordingly. You know what we want. So, straight.
Destruction of or damage to buildings. 16.1. The building comprised in the scheme is, for the purpose of this act, deemed to be destroyed A, upon the physical destruction of the building. B, when the owners by anonymous resolution so determine and all holders of registered sectional mortgage bonds and the persons with registered real rights consent agreed thereto in writing. Or when the court is satisfied that, having regard to all the circumstances, it is just and equitable that the building must be considered to have been destroyed, and makes an order to that effect. Agreed? Two, in any case where an order is made under subsection 1C, the court may impose such conditions and give such directions as it considers fit for the purpose of adjusting the effect of the order between the body corporate and the owners, and mutually amongst the owners, the holders of registered sectional mortgage bonds, and persons with registered real rights.
Chairperson, when you talk about the body corporate and the owners, is this not one and the same thing?
I don't really have a problem with it, except that I'd like to have this explained. I really just want it, as we so often say, explained in layman's language. What exactly are we saying? Because the previous subsection 1C refers to the court having made a decision that the building is destroyed. What further, I really don't attempt to say, but I just want to understand what we're trying to say here.
Firstly, can I explain that the application of this section is not only in the situation where the building is physically destroyed. Sometimes buildings get to the point where they are too old to be useful anymore, or where it is possible to build a much bigger and better building. And so you want to finish a building not because it has been destroyed. So we use the fiction of destruction, whether it's actually physically been broken down or not. Right, and the context of it, just to come right in on two, if you look at this thing, each person is the owner of a section and a share of all the common property. Layered upon that, there are people who may have a series of types of rights. There might be somebody who holds a future development right. There certainly will be, almost certainly will be people who have exclusive use rights. There will be various types of rights. You can have leasehold rights. You can have all sorts of various ancillary and derivative rights, rights that come from the primary rights in a sectional title scheme. And so the court has the opportunity to balance the interests of those parties at the table at that time. The body corporate itself is a separate legal entity. It might have debts. It might need some of the money that is going to come when this property, typically this would happen, there might be a big insurance payout, there might be a sale. It's not at all unusual for this, the context of this type of determination, to be the sale of the entire piece of property. Sometimes it gets very complex because sometimes those people want to buy into the new development. So what the court is doing is looking at where is the money going to go, who's going to get what. The body corporate, being a separate legal entity, might need some of that money to pay some of its debts. The individual owners might say, look, I own this, but my right to do that is worth that. So the court is in a position then to balance those interests, the bondholders' interests, everybody's interests. Mr. Stan, does that make sense? Thank you.
Just a person who has a problem like Mr. Stan in interpreting this clause. How are you going to mitigate? Now, a person like Mr. Taylor has got this problem. He has raised now. and then how are you going to, it means that that person has to go to the court so that he can get the explanation of that, what he's supposed to be doing in terms of this.
Would it be cheeky to say that the Community Scheme Ombuds Service will be teaching people about the complexities? Madam Chair, I answered the wrong question. Can I have another go at that? For every single body corporate, for every single sectional title scheme that is established, there is a body corporate. That is not a person in the sense of a touch and feel person. That is a person like a company or a closed corporation or a trust or something. It is an artificial person. And while every member, if you are the owner of a section in a scheme, you are automatically a member of that body corporate, whether you like it or not, you can't resign, and you are also a co-owner of all the common property. So there is like a three parts to it. You're the registered owner of a section, you're the registered owner of an undivided share in all the common property, so you're a co-owner in that regard, and you are also a member of the body corporate. So sectional title has these three elements to it, and the body corporate has to be there all the time. It represents the people. They, in a democratic way, elect trustees to operate it for them.
In the exercise of their powers under this subsection,
I'm looking at 3.1. Yeah. We're saying the owners may by unanimous resolution, and then the court. My question really is that in the preceding clause 16, we referred not only to the owners, but we referred very specifically to the holders of registered sectional mortgage bonds and persons with registered real rights to agree, for example, that the building is now, it needs to be demolished, it's sort of not safe anymore. should we not, by the same token, because now we're only leaving it up to the owners by unanimous resolution, should we not include in a situation like this where a decision has to be made whether that building is going to be reinstated, also have the persons with registered real rights or the holders of registered sectional mortgage bonds be party to that decision? So it's just a question.
I think the answer to that question is that the context of three is that there's been real damage, as in the building has been hurt in some way, part of it has fallen down or whatever, and the process that has been decided upon is that it will be rebuilt. So the context is we are actually going to put it back in terms of 3A, italics I, we are going to rebuild or reinstate the whole or the part, in which case one wouldn't think necessarily that a bondholder would be negatively affected by the fact that you're putting the security back again. Does that make sense? In essence,
the bondholder may very well, under certain circumstances, not be interested to put it back into a situation. I'm just saying, we're giving them the opportunity to, together with the owners, determine whether that building is completely should be completely destroyed and not reinstated in 16.1. Now we refer to subsection 1, but then we only leave it up to the owners. That's basically what I'm saying. We're not consistent. Because in 16.1, we actually do refer to the other people that have got rights to make a decision.
The way I see it, you don't want consistency between the two situations because they're fundamentally different. This is a situation in which you are replacing the bondholder's security. There's no prejudice to the bondholder and therefore no reason for him to consent.
I can just take the argument further. I mean, the bondholder may very well believe otherwise, that it is not in a state to be reinstated, and that their interests are going to be jeopardized if they attempt to do that. The owners may very well be selfish and thinking, well, you know, we're going to have it reinstated, not realizing the full extent, because by and large, owners are not professional people, that they're looking at their self-interest, and they're going to lose for a period or whatever, the roof over their head. So they may not look beyond that.
I was just wondering whether in 3A, that first line, because it says where the building is damaged or destroyed within the meaning of subsection 1. Doesn't that cover Mr. Stein's concern? In other words, it is destroyed, in my opinion, my understanding, it is destroyed as explained or as determined by subsection 1. So if you look at subsection 1, it seems to me that all these people you're talking about are included within that legal phrase. Am I making sense?
I think the issue of Mr. Stein is saying here, they are saying the owners now, specifically. It says where the building is damaged or destroyed within the meaning of subsection 1. The owners, that's where the point Mr. Stein is here is going now. It's specific around the owners. Yeah, whereas in subsection 1C, all those people were mentioned there. I don't know.
May I just follow my point? That's exactly what I'm arguing, that when you say within the meaning of subsection 1, are you not therefore including those people that were mentioned in that subsection? Are they not included automatically within that phrase, within the meaning of subsection 1? What does that mean, Dave?
I would love to tell you that I agreed with you, but unfortunately I can't. The the cross-reference to subsection 1 contemplates a situation where it's not actually necessarily destroyed. So 1A deals with physical destruction. 1B deals with a situation, as you suggest, where the bondholders and owners agree that it will be considered to be destroyed, whether in fact it is or not. And 1C deals with a situation where the court makes a decision. So Mr. Sain is correct that cross-reference doesn't necessarily bring the bondholders into play. But there's no harm in what Mr. Sain says. My instructions are that the department would be perfectly happy with that.
In fact, Chair, the point made by my colleague here emphasizes my concern, because by referring to sections 1, you're saying that everybody there together agreed that the building was destroyed. But now you're giving only the owners the opportunity actually to turn their decision around. That is what this is saying. You're saying everybody there agreed that it's for the physical destruction or in writing or whatever. But now the owners can go against that agreement, really, and decide that they want to reinstate it.
Let's conclude by saying members are not happy. Members are not happy about this account. Bohi, Inchola, Daniel Yance, New Brick, Daush, Quail Printer.
Bohi said there was no point.
B, in the exercise of their powers under the subsection, the owners may pass such a resolution as they may consider fit, or the court may make such order as it may consider necessary or expedient to give effect to the scheme in connection with, amongst other things, 1, the application of insurance monies received by the body corporate in respect of damage to or the destruction of the building.
Nee. Why can't you put shall? What's the difference on this one of in the exercise of their powers under this subsection, the owner shall? So they may or may not. Does that imply that?
May is the right one here because they don't have to. So must would be the wrong one. And this is giving them a power, but not an obligation.
B, the payment of money by or to the body corporate or by or to the owners or by or to one or more of the owners.
Just read in the exercise and then jump to 2. Ne? Let me put your order by your hand.
Okay. In the exercise of their powers under this subsection, the owners may pass such a resolution as they may consider fit, or the court may make such order as it may consider necessary or expedient to give effect to the scheme in connection with, amongst other things, 1, the application of insurance monies received by the body corporate in respect of damage to or the destruction of the building. 2, the payment of money by or to the body corporate or by or to the owners or by or to one or more of the owners.
Agreed. That's a little drafting.
Yeah. An amendment an amendment of the sectional plan so as to include an addition to or a subtraction from the common property. For the variation of the quota of any section.
I don't know. If before we get to three, okay, continue because I'll add this at the end of after five.
Okay, thank you, Chair. The variation of the quota of any section, or five, the imposition of conditions.
What does it mean then? Before the court, I think we are given a court to rule, and then after they make a ruling on that one, in terms of 1, 2, 3, and 4, the variation of quota is imposition of that condition. Because the condition would have been elaborated on. Why do you need to put again imposition of condition that already agreed on?
The nature of a sectional title scheme is made up of a lot of fairly complex things which conveyances understand in depth. One of those things is title deed conditions. And the very nature of the scheme can be changed by the way in which those conditions are imposed. This simply adds to the list of things the court can do, the power to impose or change conditions. So in essence, it's just one of many things. We're talking about a situation where the scheme is going to change in some way. Something might be added in, something might be taken away. So a condition, an example of a condition might be some sort of right of way or something that is necessary to hold this new thing together. There's no danger in this thing.
I understand what is being said. I'm just wondering, would it be easier or perhaps more understandable if we had to say the imposition of any other conditions? Would that help it at all? Because this appears to be a condition. And if you say any other, it just, again, broadens it to all the other things that were spoken about.
A submission that suggested that an additional subsection be included, providing that if any insurance monies are paid out following destruction of portion of the whole of a unit, that such money should not be paid directly to the owner. While not stated explicitly, these comments suggest that owners may not use money for intended purposes. So can you just think about it? Directly to the owner.
Chair, I would actually like to see that before I comment on it. My initial thought, please, trying to hold what you've just said in my head, is that it is the body corporate that has the statutory obligation to insure, and therefore it would be the body corporate that would be the person to whom the money was paid. In a situation where money is paid directly to an owner, one would expect that would be in terms of one of those other insurance policies. So I'm not sure that is necessary. If you have one of those insurance policies, why wouldn't you have the right to have the money?
Thank you, Chair. For an application may, for the purposes of this section, be made to the court by the body corporate or by any owner or by any holder of a registered sectional mortgage bond or a registered lease or by any insurer who has obtained insurance on the building or buildings or any section therein or by the municipality.
Okay, I'm just wondering, I think we're obviously referring to the application in D1. So if that is the case, just to make it clearer, should we not say an application is contemplated in subsection 3B1 or something to that effect? If it's tied to this, otherwise if it's just another application, then it obviously stays. I just want some clarity.
Chairperson, yes, just to say in line 36, who has obtained insurance on, it's been suggested that that be of. Take out the whole of that, who has obtained insurance on, or by any insurer of the building, agreed.
My understanding is that's not tied. There are a number of situations under this clause where somebody can make an application to court. The phrase one is referring to is an application to court, to the court. So I think it should be a general reference as it is.
Any insurer who has obtained insurance on the building or buildings or any part thereof, being insurance against destruction of sections or damage to the building, has the right to intervene in the proceedings on any application to the court under this section. Agreed?
I think that the same applies here. Any insurer, and then delete who has obtained insurance on it. Exactly the same as in the previous number, replaced with of. Got that?
The court may, on the application of a body corporate or any member thereof or any holder of a registered real right, consent, or any judgment creditor, by order, make provisions for the winding up of the affairs of the body corporate. The court may, by the same or any subsequent order, declare the body corporate dissolved as from a date specified in the order. The court may...
Apologies, can I just take us back to the previous one, which was, I think, 6A. Earlier, we made provision for an administrator to be appointed. Now, the administrator, in then taking over the management, so to speak, may find that it is wise to wind up very much like anybody else here, like a creditor and so on. Should we therefore not make allowance for the administrator similarly to make an application to the court? So we include not only on application of a body corporate, etc., and everybody else, but also an application by an appointed administrator.
Off the top of my head, Chairperson, that sounds like a very sensible suggestion.
You said that before we go to B. What else are you saying, Mr. Steno? Where should that be accommodated?
Chair, it can really be accommodated anywhere in the sentence. It could even be after judgment creditor.
Okay.
The court may, with regard to any application under this section, make such order for the payment of costs as it considers fit. Where two or more buildings are comprised in a scheme, then only one or part of one of the said buildings is damaged or destroyed, the provisions of this section apply with the necessary changes required by the context, as if the said buildings were one building and part of such building has been damaged or destroyed. When in terms of subsection 1, the building comprised in a scheme is considered to be destroyed and the owners have by anonymous resolution resolved not to rebuild the building, the body corporate must lodge with the register of deeds a notification in the form and with such supporting documents as may be prescribed in terms of sectional titles.
Very small thing, and it may or may not be correct, but do we need to have, after in line 56, deeds and notification in the form, and to have that, I think it's a comma, I've done so much over it, I'm not too sure what it was, I think it's a comma. Do we need that comma there?
I'm really raising the same concern that I had in 3A, where it referred to owners by unanimous resolution, because this basically refers to that resolution. And the concern they raised was the other interested parties were not represented. So, and I think that there was going to be a redrafting of that, so that could be considered here as well.
Council 17.1. There is hereby established a sectional title scheme management advisory council. Open bracket in this section referred to as the advisory council. Close bracket, which must A, make recommendations to the minister concerning any matter specified in section 18, in respect thereof, the minister may make regulations. B, keep the implementation of this act and the regulations under regular review, and may make recommendations to the minister with regards to any amendments thereof or other actions which may be advisable. And C, advise the minister on any matter referred to it by the minister.
Thank you, Chair. I'm checking when they say and may make recommendation to the minister. May make the recommendation to the minister. They should not, they must.
If there are things to make recommendations about, then they may do that. They have the entitlement to do that. But if they don't have anything to suggest to the minister, then I think an obligation to make recommendations is probably not sensible. They have the power to do it whenever they think that's necessary. To say that they must always do it presupposes there will always be something to recommend. I believe that this is the correct phrase here.
Chair, I must admit I support my colleague in this. Because if we make it may, the fact of the matter is this advisory body is established precisely to do these things. If something doesn't exist, then they don't have to. What we are saying is that they must make recommendation if it exists. We actually, by saying may, we're giving them the option whether that arbitrary thing there that needs to be amended is there or not. So I think what we are trying to say is if there's something that needs to be amended, because that's why they are being established, they then must. If it's not there, then obviously they don't have to. So I would I concur with my colleague that I'd like to see a change to must. They must make
even put poison in my nose. I concur with the members that are saying at least there must be. They have to make recommendations, because if they have to make those recommendations to the minister, they cannot just decide. And the other thing I wanted to check, I don't know whether we have defined this advisory council. Do we have in our definition? Because if we're going to have the more especially the very important have we defined it? Advisory council? No?
It is defined in 17.1. There's a specific definition in 17.1.
No. The definitions are put at the first page. You can't say you have defined it. You have to define it at the first page. Because when you talk of the advisors, won't we? It's very intimidating. So I wanted to check that, but we will get the response from the state law advisor. Is it correct if it is there?
It has been referred to in 17.1. And yeah, the very same section that we are reading, 17.1, we're saying we are establishing the sectional title scheme management advisory council in this section referred to as the advice.
I'm
trying to explain, Chairperson. The reason why we have it here is because it has been only referred to once, only in this section. There's nowhere else in the Act whereby it has been referred to. That's why you don't need to define it in the general clause. It was only referred to once, only here in this section. It's not used elsewhere in the Act or in the bill.
Into this section. But I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced.
No, sure, no. Well, I just get that, Bong, and there will be no harm really to put it there. I'm not sure what would be the harm to define, because it's a very important body that may advise the minister. And then if there are issues that are referred to the council by the minister, they may advise, they may also not advise if issues anyway that are running correctly. I think that would be fine. I don't see any problem really putting it somewhere. If you can do that, there's no harm at all. And then surely it's a very important vote in my view that will assist the minister from time to time. And they may from time to time advise the minister for various issues, really. And then if they want amendment, they want to propose other changes, I think that they should do. And then I think we should put it somewhere, really, Bonga. I don't think there's any harm for it, in my view. I'm not sure, in fact, why we should just put it somewhere. It's very useful board. And I'm not sure anyway how many agencies now. It's another board that they are creating. And Gomez would every month to create a new board.
Thank you, Chad. I think there's no harm. You know, we'll of course consider that. I think the other point, Honorable Chair, I think that I need to emphasize that if you ever look at 17, it provides that there is hereby established a sectional title schemes management advisory council which must, I think Mr. Chairman said, which must make recommendations. Those are the things that actually it's expected to do. It must do those. Two, the advisory council consists of the chief ombud, who must act as a chairperson at the meetings of the advisory council. B, persons appointed by the minister who must have specialized knowledge of the sectional title schemes management and who must include one, an owner of a unit in a residential scheme, an owner who occupies a unit in a commercial scheme, an owner who occupies a unit in a non-residential or mixed-use scheme, a professional managing agent with experience in giving management services to a range of types of schemes, a person with experience in the development of sectional title schemes, a person with experience in the financing of sectional title development, and lastly, an official of the department.
No, I've got questions. No, I don't agree. I want to check the level of this official, because I've seen a good decision making capacity. So I think the level should be indicated, in my opinion. And that's the second point. And then, yeah, must just not be an official. So you can work at, you can look at that. And then the other issue, why is only an owner? And then the occupier is not inclusive in B1. And number three, who will provide the secretarial services to this? Because when you get down, you'll find that there are minutes, there's something, minutes that have to be kept. Who's keeping the minutes? Because the minutes are kept by the secretary. So in this instance, who's going to play that role?
I think the idea behind that was that the chief ombud would have the staff to be able to handle that. Of course, it's something that the chief ombud is the chair.
Well, the owners are too many, anyway. I just guess that owners are very important in the scheme. They must play that democratic role there. But I do think that also you will put ready, because the minister may want to appoint another person that he fits him to appoint. I don't think we should close it from the minister in terms of the act. I think you are very specific in other areas. I guess that they should be, I think eight, it should be also allowing just liberty for a minister to appoint whoever he can see there's a fit person to do whatever thing, because we may have all of the things that we have specified here. He may really come to a conclusion that there's another person who's not necessarily explained in terms of the act, but he may want to improve for various reasons. I don't think we should close it in such a way that the minister can't see a person team fit to serve in this the advisory committee or advisory council. And I think my view, we should really allow that space for the minister to do that. Because I think we are specific in other areas, who is going to be the chairperson and who is going to do what. And then I think also we must allow just a leeway for the minister to appoint whoever really deems fit to serve in advisory council.
I think that one, I cannot dispute that one. It's a valid point. You have to add, make them eight instead of seven. And then, we are saying, all those people we have put there, we agree. But what we are proposing is that at least let's give the minister an opportunity. Because it might happen that there's a person that the minister might think that he needs to appoint but does not fall under this category you have. So we are saying, please just look at that and fit some way. And then I still insist that we need to have a person who's going to act as a secretary. You cannot just think it's somebody from the other legislation. It must be at least understood who is going to act as a secretary. So another thing, time is 4:05. This meeting was scheduled for 4:00. And I don't think we all thought that it's going to take us. This is
guidance from the member. But what do we do? Because we thought we can finish it at least so that next week we deliberate on ourselves. I don't know. I need guidance.
May we propose that maybe we should push until 5:30 or 5:30. And then, because some of the areas that are coming now, I think they are much more, they are no longer contentious issues. Because they are covered somewhere where we have fought on. And I think we can make it at 5:30 or 4:30. I think that if we give us some time more, I think we can really do the work that we wanted us to do. Because it's important that we conclude what's 4:30.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. If that was, of course, if the members are cut already. But I think upper part, we share. Because I think that's important for us as a meeting to conclude what we wanted to conclude today. And then I think 5:30 we can make it today. And then the bus would have enough time really to prepare for the next bus.
Going to second it, except I think we're going to be finished by certainly at the latest by 5:00. As Richard said, there's no contentious issues. There's one or two amendments that I certainly have in the next lot, and that's it. But yes, I think we should try and finish it. Chair.
Because it means now, for every member of the advisory council, there must be an alternate member. What does that mean? Appointed in the same manner as such member. What is this? Because if there are 9 members, there should be other 9 members appointed. I want to check something. Are the advisors to the minister not paid? Are they paid? It means now this thing is going to come to the budget of Parliament. You're going to appoint alternate, and then those people are going to be paid by Parliament because the minister is the advisor to the minister. Because we don't want things that are going to fail really. If you are saying that is an advisor to the minister, I want to know, is there no remuneration? If there is remuneration, why should you appoint alternatives?
Chairperson, the advisors to the minister are paid in terms of rates determined by the National Treasury, and they are paid as their attendance to a meeting. So if there are alternatives, it means people who are on standby, in case one is unable to attend the meeting, then the standby goes in. There won't be any double claims, because members claim their attendance of the meeting.
I think it's fine if they're not going to be paid by attending the meeting and register, citing the reason that why there will be no toll payment. But I just guess that if we appoint all of them in a similar way, I think it's better. You can't find a better route of doing that. Because I think the rationale of it is that if the advocate is not there, another person must come in. But don't forget that the quorum here, because they will need the quorum to take it. I'm not sure what is the quorum anyway, professor, for them to take it, since they want to advise it. In other words, you need a quorum for people who advise it. You don't need it, either somebody needs to complete it. I guess we may not need it, because they are just advised, depending whether the minister accepts the advice or not, is the immaturity. But I think that is a, it is a very big team already. And in general, I guess that if you have two, 19 of them or 18 of them, so it's international. But of course, provided if one doesn't come, one will come. The likelihood for people to sit down and just be alternating meetings of and then bearing in mind that you want the consistency in meetings because you want people who will be informed by what is happening on the daily meetings. You don't want great people who seem to be all that they can sit down with the meeting and agree that the next meeting you attend, the next meeting I attend. Because it's almost a permanent alternate. And then in my view, I don't think it makes national sense in a lot of things. I wouldn't die for it if the speaker thing they think, but I don't think we should do so. And then I don't think we should do so. Because these are advisors anyway. They don't take any binding decision for any human being. And then even there are five, if they meet, there are five, they can take an advisory role and give it to a minister, the judge or assembly. I don't think they dispose of this as many people as I think. And then if it doesn't harm anyone, I think we should just get rid of it. We should have this now.
So I must confess to not having had any sort of decision one way or another, but I think I've been convinced by your arguments. The somewhere further down it indicates that five members will form a quorum. Now if we've got nine, chances are you should have five at any one stage, and we do make allowances for members that resign or that through some other ways aren't able to be members anymore, whether they pass on or not, to be replaced. So I would therefore go along with the suggestion that we do not have the alternates. I think the ombudsman will have an alternate or a deputy, and that's fine. I support this argument, Chair.
I agree. Okay. Omit 5. And 5, before the minister makes an appointment in terms of subsection 2B, the Director General must, on such terms as he or she consider appropriate, establish a nomination committee comprising persons who are broadly representative of the various racial groups and geographical areas of the Republic, including both males and females, to nominate persons who meet the requirements of subsection 2B for the consideration for appointment to the Advisory Council by the Minister.
Mr.
Clause 4, I thought we stopped on 3 on the alternates, and he's now on 5. My apologies. On 4, the chief ombud may designate a person as an alternate chairperson when he or she is unable to attend the meetings of the advisory council. Part A, before the minister makes an appointment in terms of subsection 2B, the director general must, on such terms as he or she considers appropriate, establish a nomination committee comprising persons who are broadly representative of the various racial groups and geographical areas of the Republic, including both males and females, to nominate persons who meet the requirements of subsection 2B for consideration for appointment to the Advisory Council by the Minister.
That nomination committee, where does Parliament sit? May I ask?
What is the term of office of the advisory council?
And I think the drafters, they will find a better legal way to put it. In general, I think we are talking about an audit system advisory council. I don't think one should define it on racial groups and gender. I think it is acceptable that an audit system advisory board will be included by a large, because that is appreciated in other laws of the country. And I don't think we need to put it here. If
I think we're right to not see the bias, three bias. Is I know I don't believe anything. Yeah. I think we're yes.
Chair, I'm sorry to take you back. The number four, when we are now giving the power to Chief Ombud to appoint an alternate chairperson, what will be the power of the Chief Ombud?
I think we need to, because the chief Ombud will have a deputy. So let's do away from this alternate. Let's say, because automatically, when you chief Ombud, deputy should chair. Unless they are not there, you know. If they are not there, both of them. So, because it might happen that they won't be there in a specific meeting. So the chief can designate somebody, or the people in the meeting, the people who are in the meeting at that particular, at that particular session, they may elect amongst themselves.
Chair, you preempting one of my suggestions, which was under clause 10, and perhaps we should look at perhaps 5 must go out, 4 must go out, because 10 we refer to the chief ombud or his alternate or the official that must act as chairperson. And I wanted to raise under clause 10, what happens if also that official is not there? Because we know that officials sit on many, very many boards, and they sometimes attend the least amount of meetings. And to take your point that the members present must then elect the chair, but that was under clause 10 that I wanted to bring it up. So perhaps clause 4 need to fall away because it's covered somewhat under 10.
Well, I think this is not the first legislation we are asked, which is results that are under it. No, at least the people in the meeting, if the ombud and the deputy are not there, the people who are in the meeting, they may nominate anyone to chair the meeting amongst themselves.
On clause 10. Okay. They agree that they're going to delete 4.
We should delete 4 because it's the one that is providing for the designation of the deputy, and then in turn it's talking as if it's already the deputy is already there.
4 is the one that is providing for the chief ombud to nominate a person as a deputy. I think we need to have... Is it one of the members?
Is there quicker legislation, the second legislation? We are going to put him. We are going to put the deputy. We couldn't say that we couldn't.
We are talking of the deputy for the purposes of the advisory council. The chief ombud is a chairperson, and now in order to provide for his deputy, then we need to have a clause to state talking to that effect. But not that there's no deputy chief ombud. Yeah, for the purpose of this office, the ombud. I mean, sorry, the advisory council. We have a chairperson, now we are providing for the nomination or the election of the deputy chairperson. Deputy chairperson, not deputy chief ombud, the deputy chairperson. And then in the absence of both the chairperson and the deputy chairperson, then the members present may elect amongst themselves the person to act as a chairperson in that meeting. There has to be a deputy. The chief ombud is the chairperson. We all agree. But now, the deputy chairperson is appointed by the minister. Am I right? It's appointed by the ombud amongst these members. What's the thing?
I think we're conflating issues here now. This one. I think the other bill would refer to a deputy ombudsman. This one is purely referring to an alternate chairperson and not a deputy ombudsman. And perhaps our legal person is correct in saying 4 must stay, but then perhaps 10 must go out. Because what I want to suggest is when the chief ombudsman chooses an alternate, and I don't know how we're going to put this, he must actually then choose somebody that he knows is going to be present at the meeting to be the alternate chairperson. And that will do away with the clause 10, actually.
Mr. Steng, that is why I was asking if the ombudsperson is not going to attend that particular meeting, why can't the deputy ombudsperson, or because we have got a deputy ombudsperson, legislation lay hangers like I am.
Sorry. The legislation does not provide for a deputy ombudsman. It's not there in the legislation. So we can't put it here. We can't preempt that we require that in terms of the legislation that is still going to be considered.
I thought the point that was raised earlier on, when I agree with Paul must remain, I think it's important because of the training. But the important is shared. I thought that what we're trying to say anyway, that the will, one way or another, not a deputy, you won't appoint a deputy home, but you will appoint a deputy. When he's not there, then that person then will preside over the meeting. And then I think we'll, of course, doing this thing among those who are members of this advisory council. I think that will be fine. When we come for the discussion on the ombudsman, then I think we can then see how do we link the two. But for the sake of this legislation, I think we should do that. There's not an impediment that we'll put on that one. But I guess that there was a point that was raised earlier, and I'm not sure where is it elaborated or that if the chair and the deputy are not the members of the meeting, they will decide who should preside over that particular meeting for specific reasons. And then I think somewhere, I'm not sure it is there or not. If it's there, it's fine. If it's not there, again, I think we'll work for that.
Thank you, Chair. persons nominated in terms of paragraph A must be broadly representative of the various racial groups and geographical areas of the Republic, including both males and females. But we have noted the comment earlier on by Honorable Richard, you know, with regard to this issue. Six, a member of the Advisory Council holds office for a period of 3 years, but the minister may, on a reasonable grounds, terminate the appointment of such a member at any time before the expiration of such a member's period of office. Agreed? If a member of the Advisory Council dies or vacates office before the expiration of that member's period of office, the minister may, subject to the provisions of subsection 2B, appoint any person in that member's place for the unexpired period of his or her office. Unexpired office.
Under subsection 2B.
Appoint any person in that member's place for the unexpired period of his or her
office. Okay. The provision
not
sufficient to appoint
yes.
any person.
8. A member of the advisory council.
I'm trying to delete that in appoint a person. Just any person. I could contact the national contradiction of Mr. State.
A member.
That's point 2B. So point 2B is 99, yeah. So la appoint any person.
A member of the advisory council whose period of office has expired may be reappointed but may not serve for more than 2 consecutive terms. Agreed? A member of the advisory council, excluding a member in a full-time service of the state, must, while he or she is engaged in the business of the advisory council, be paid such remuneration and traveling and subsistence allowances as the minister, with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, may determine.
I think in terms of treasury guidelines, a person who is in the employment of the state may serve in this body, but may not be paid.
He's saying excluding a member in the full-time service of the state. You agree, sir? Excluding. Yes.
The allowances, why must they be the same as that of a minister? Because they are not ministers, just advisory council. Thank you, Chair.
It said, and subsistence allowance as the minister, with the concurrence of the minister, may determine. But again, the funa ibe clear to a treasury guidelines. Because I want to know the funa, and then I thought of the one's scriptures in court where one might decide. But for the sake of my understanding, they can be clear in terms of the treasury guidelines, because they are children.
In the absence of the chief ombud or his or her alternative, the official referred to in subsection 2B4 must act as chairperson of the advisory council.
there. This is where we had a bit of confusion, and I agree now, clause four should remain.
Yeah.
And perhaps in clause 10, we should make an allowance for the members present, rather than the official, for the members present to then elect a chairperson for that meeting.
Yeah.
I agree, Chair. 11, the advisory council must meet at such times and places as are determined by the chief ombud.
We are in a democratic country. Why finally determine umuntu oyiwona?
The advisory council must meet at such times and places as are determined by the chief ombud. Manje
normally in practice, the chairperson will call for a meeting, and as a result, will also issue notices and will serve notices to the members, you know, to inform them of the, you know, of the venue and the meeting. And if they've got any objections, they'll of course raise any objection. Some of the members.
Who will come to say notices when they don't have the sick?
I think it's also convention. If I was a member of the advisory council and I had something of importance, I would request the chairperson to call a meeting. That's the one issue. But just to I think, allay your fears about the secretary chair, we're forgetting there's another bill where the chief ombud will have a full staff, and he'll obviously make use of that staff. This is just one of his duties in terms of the other bill.
We don't have a problem on that, but we tend to contradict us. When we refer to the other bill, we are called to order. We do not talk about the other bill. So that is why I'm asking this question. We must be consistent.
The advisory council, the minister may at any time direct the chief ombuds to convene a meeting of the advisory council at a time and place determined by the minister. Response to that is that if you can have a look at 1C, it says that the advisory council must advise the minister on any matter referred to it by the minister. Meaning that the minister, you know, that qualifies a particular provision. A decision of a majority of the members of the advisory council. Five members. My apologies, honorable members. Five members of the advisory council, one of whom must be the chief ombud or his or her alternative, forms a quorum for a meeting.
I just care that we should also give ministers and special powers on this one. To me, really, for a minister to intervene, to instruct or to direct, I think really only if the board or the advisor, the council, does see it as well. Absolutely, it would be very dangerous in fact if we do that. In my view, there should be a qualification why the minister can instruct a chairperson of the board, of the advisory council. because I assume that people are going to be appointed here will be reasonable enough to understand that they need to advise the minister on any matter that is referred to them. And then failure to do that, then I think the minister can then act upon it. But I think we should give some qualification. We shouldn't really give it like that. It would be almost a better power for a minister. This is not a minister's committee, anyway, subcommittee. It's a board. It's an advisory council, but advising the minister. I don't think the minister should be. Anytime if you want to call it, to call a meeting, you call a meeting. And also, you are passing an act anyway. That should anyway stand the test of time. And then because you are not passing an act that you are amendatory at time, should stand the test of time for many years. Therefore, it's very important that whatever we do today, it should really for generations. Because otherwise, it's very easy to do this thing for whatever contextual situation. But it's not really about that here. But in law, an act that you are going to pass in parliament, then to stand the test of time for many years to come. And then when you want to say, you can put your hand for it, call a meeting, and need an advice.
I must say, I didn't know Richard had such little faith in his ministers. I think the advisory board is exactly that, and the minister must and should feel free to call upon them at any time. And I can't see any minister, including DA ministers, that would unnecessarily call a meeting. We need to leave it to the discretion of the minister that he's aware of something that may not have been brought to his attention, and he must then have the liberty to call the committee so that he can get the expertise. So I certainly wouldn't change anything in terms of it. I'd leave it as it is.
We concur with Honourable Stan. This is the minister's in charge of this act. This is not one in which, in terms of which the chief ombuds is in charge. His ambit is a wider one. Here, it's the minister is responsible for this particular act, and the minister must have the power to call a meeting.
Chairperson, I concur with my colleagues, but perhaps we could water this thing down by saying the minister may refer any matter rather than instructing them to call a meeting. The minister may refer any matter, any agent matter, to the council for their consideration rather than saying he may instruct. I think I agree with
A decision of a majority of the members of the advisory council present at any meeting of the advisory council constitutes a decision of the advisory council, and
12A. Richard distracted me here. 12A. We earlier agreed that the meeting will if the ombudsman, the chief ombud, and his or her alternate is not there, that the members may elect a chairperson. Now we're saying here that if the chief ombud or his or her alternative is not there, then in fact there's no quorum, because we say they must be present to form a quorum. So if we're going to allow the members, any other five members or seven members that's there, then this shouldn't apply. Five members of the advisory council form a quorum for a meeting.
Any five members of the committee to form a quorum. Because really, you avoid that the office on the alternate must be there for a quorum to be. Things are in the hospital for 2 years, there will be no meeting. And then both of them, you have to change the law. I think that's a danger of something that we can't stand the test of time. So we have to change it every week because it must stand the test of time. The law must do that to us. Otherwise, we'll be arrested somewhere.
I take Richard's point, and it's a very valid point. But I'm not sure. Could there not be something in the regulations that says that the chief ombud, for example, should not miss two meetings in succession or something to that effect?
Let's stick to this one, and then in the regulations, you will be there. Saying let's not include it here. It's going to be included in the regulations. And I'm saying it's a stain because those regulations, before they are approved, they will go via Mr. Stain. I don't know what's the problem.
A decision of a majority of the members of the Advisory Council present at any meeting of the Advisory Council constitute a decision of the Advisory Council, and in the event of an equality of votes, the person presiding at the meeting must have a casting vote in addition to his or her deliberative vote. Agreed? The Advisory Council may regulate the proceedings at its meetings as it may think fit and must cause meetings of such proceedings to be kept.
As advisors, as one, as life fiduciary obligation.
Chairperson, they are not a board. They are not looking after our assets of any entity. So they wouldn't be having any fiduciary responsibility. Interest, yes. If there is any, will be vetted when they are being evaluated to be appointed on the board, as we did with Shira.
I think it is closer. Look, there has to be. No. I'm talking about, but it's not one issue. It's not one issue, it's not one matter. Even the disclosure of interest, it is important. It falls under a fiduciary obligation.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 18 regulations. The Minister may make regulations regarding A, any matter required or permitted to be prescribed by regulations under this Act, B, and generally any matter that is necessary or expedient to prescribe for the proper implementation of this Act.
May. Why must? Why without consultation with the advisor, the counsel? No, we're still coming to that one. Why not, I think the advisory council, because the advisory council have to consult maybe with the body corporate, because they are not just advising, it's to me, they're advising about the issues of sectional title, I don't know. So why can't those issues, the other one, last year, the minister consult an advisory council, yeah. The advisory council, when somebody consulting the board corporate, before all your advisors, they must check mama issues in the board corporate, because they are dealing with the issues of the sectional title management scheme. But I'm not clear what the farmer needs in the fund, but the name the task would amba no is there. But the mama didn't ask.
I think it is provided in section 17. Yes. Subsection 1. A. Make recommendations to the minister concerning any matter specified in section 18 in respect. Section 18 is regulations. In respect of section 17, one of the matters that the minister can consult the advisory council is the making of regulations in terms of section 18. I thought the concern of the chairperson was with regard to the fact that the minister can make regulations without consulting the advisory council. So I was saying it's provided in section 17 of the legislation.
No, I can see it now. I can see it. Then let's check the issue of general matter that is... Who accounts to Parliament about these regulations of the Act itself? Who's accountable? Who accounts to Parliament? Because at the end of the day, I'm asking them. Because at the end of the day, I think Parliament is responsible for each and every legislation that is there, because we play oversight in the legislation. As we repeat the whole start, we're saying the whole start. Brought before the committee prior, before Parliament, not committee, Parliament prior final approval. Yeah, machine abu more than full thought. I, the lack of fourth Parliament is such, the lack of chocolate Parliament, we are still saying so. You must insert it. And then you define Parliament. You know that. Yes. So this thing I want to work on that.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I have noted that comment. 19, amendment of Act 95 of 86. 19, the Sectional Titles Act 1986, Act number 95 of 1986, is hereby amended to the extent set out in the third column of the schedule.
Before we get there, I think there was that delegation by the minister. We have omitted that the minister may delegate, but may not delegate power to make regulations, Mr. Ngomiso. Minister may not delegate the power to make regulations. You know that. Then the second point, the minister may delegate DG or assign any of his or what of her duties imposed on him or by this act. That is, for instance, reporting to Parliament. Minister report to Parliament or may designate the DG. We have had that standard. You know that standard in the legislation, the last legislation that we passed. Look at the APA and the... Yeah, you know...
I think it's important, you know, point out you need to note, say that
the minister in this particular case does not have any, you know, power, you know, really, in terms of this case, except what is provided for, let me say, you know, in terms of, you know, Section 70. I think the point is that what I'm trying to make is that in terms of this piece of legislation that is before the members, the minister really does not have much powers in terms of this particular piece, except the powers as provided for in terms of 17 and 18. But however, a provision, it can be provided to say, you know, the minister must after consult make regulations, you know, with parliament. That provision is not being provided for another piece of legislation. But what I'm trying to emphasize is that by virtue of, you know, the piece, you know, that is before you, the minister does not have real powers in terms of this piece, except in, you know, in 17 and 18. My apologies. Transitional arrangement, 20. Rules prescribed under the Sectional Titles Act must continue to apply to new and existing schemes until the minister has made regulations prescribing management rules and conduct rules referred to in Section 92 of this Act.
Sorry, just on 19. We've obviously made some changes to certain clause numbers in this Act, and in the schedule there's reference to clause numbers as it currently stands. So if you could just make sure that where we've made an amendment to a clause number, that it's now, you go through the schedule and you amend them accordingly.
Yes, we'll do that. Noted, Mr. Short title and commencement. 21. This Act is called the Sectional Titles Schemes Management Act 2010 and comes into operation on a date fixed by the President by proclamation in the Gazette.
Actually, we're not done. We're done with the sectional title schemes management. And then there's still a schedule that we still need to consider because it's a constitutional amendment to the Sectional Titles Act. It is part of the schedule to the bill, so that needs to be considered by the committee, those amendments to the sectional titles. Yeah, the schedule will be considered by the committee also.
Bondi, you are saying these amendments of the Sectional Titles Act have to be considered by us.
They are consequential amendments as a result of this legislation.
I do think that Ubong is saying this is a consequential amendment, which they wouldn't deal with the substantive nature of the bill. Because we have resolved all substantive matter in the bill. What is here is just a consequential thing that must follow the amendment that we have made before. We can do these things before our upper five. Surely we can do it before our upper five. Because it's not. That I'm trying to raise is that because these are consequential matters, just as a result as we amend the main bill, they shouldn't be contentious and also not substantive. And then in my view, really, within 20 minutes, we can be through with the overall thing. It's not very difficult really at all to do it that way. Because we have dealt with the main B, and then to me, consequential one, we should really do it now.
So the button is gone. Whilst I agree with Richard, we actually can't do it unless we've got that particular act in front of us. And we don't. We need that Sectional Titles Act 95 of 1986 in order to do it. Because I think the process thus far has shown us that we can't really accept everything that the department gives us. We may pick up some errors that they've got in the schedule. With respect.
We have gone really an extra mile. We have done a remarkable job. We have to get ourselves, because we have made our homework. You know, I never thought that today will take so long. I thought because we were left with only 3 or 4 pages, so I thought it was going to be easier. But I think I have to thank members for that, and even the department. We really thank you. We are going to proceed, I think, Tuesday. When are we meeting? On Tuesday. And on Tuesday, we are going to deliberate on this one. But before deliberations, we can begin, if you can provide with us a copy of the legislation, sectional title. This sectional title thing. Yes, okay.
Boom, before Boom has disappeared. And because Mama Boom will assist us here, because I always thought that the schedule matter. It is a consequential matter, therefore the people who are dealing with the legal issues will work it out. Precisely because it doesn't need another discussion on substantive issues that the committee must look at. It's just really referring to a bill to say this is clause 20. Is it clause 20 amended accordingly? And what is the consequence of clause A if it's amended this way? Really, I thought that is not a bigger issue, because there's no impact on the amended law with the schedule generally. It's put there for explanation, to do other things. Really, I don't think that is a very difficult matter at all. But yeah, I accept that on next week, Tuesday or Wednesday, we can finalize that. It's just boring in the team, they must assist us when we meet, that the whole issue there should come a little bit easy. Otherwise, the tendency will be there again to rediscuss the whole substantive bill if you're not clarifying the two issues very clearly.
But I think the team will work it out.
Is that next week now? When? They can assist us now. Ning assist is saying something like this. It must be like on like this now. All the
only when
we're finalizing it.
Only when we finalize it, I agree to
before adoption. No, we can't adopt. No. Generally, workshop. We can't adopt in a bill like this. It must be. We can adopt it, say, that you will get it. We can't adopt it. We can't. Yes, it must be clean. No. We're just deliberating. But deliberating next week. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
In for Bongi. Can you assist here? Wasn't the Sectional Titles Act, as we, this 95, wasn't it amended by the Rural Development Portfolio Committee?
It was.
When we look at the schedule, which one do we compare it to the amended one or the old one?
No, we can read in the amendment.
Once we have we have adopted this one, after we have looked at it, amended it, it becomes the principal F. Because then that will supersede the rural development one. No, it should be. No. That's why they must.
Rural development is amending that act.
Yeah.
We have been taking into account their changes, and they have agreed to all these changes that are in the schedule. So what's happened is, as they make a change, we make the change, so that what we do, so that we do mirrors what they are doing. Right. So all these changes set out in the thing you made, in the schedule, have been agreed with rural development. Some of their changes need to be made now, and some of those changes only come in when this Act comes in, because this Act presupposes the Chief Ombud and various other things, which don't exist at the moment.
Right, so it is our team that has met and agreed, because I don't recall any joint meeting with rural meeting. It seems that the legal team has met and agreed in terms of the amendment. That the act, if you are passing it, shouldn't contradict the existing one. Okay. No, that's fine.
I think we that's a bit confusing. You are released, member, department.
Tuesday, or Tuesday, Wednesday. Morning, afternoon, sort of thing.
Thank you very much. Thank you.